You've hit play on The Screen Companion, an eclectic mix of film and TV recommendations.
Connect with The Screen Companion via our Facebook group, by subscribing on YouTube or whatever platform you're listening on, and email us using thescreencompanion@gmail.com.
Spotlighting the one, the only, Tom Cruise, whose career has spanned multiple decades. Today I've got John and Andrew with me, and we're going to do Born on the 4th of July from 1989, as well as his most recent picture as of this recording, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. Andrew, if you could start us off giving us a little summary of what Born on the 4th of July is about.
A biographical flick written by Oliver Stone and the guy whose life it's about, Ron Kovic. It's his journey from flag-waving patriot who was literally born on the 4th of July to crippled Vietnam vet who's anti-war.
John, Tom Cruise plays Kovic from high school to 30. Which era do you think he plays the best?
Well, he's over in Vietnam, because he's just slightly too intense for an actual teenager. He's still a very young man playing in this movie. So, yeah, I'm going to say when he's in Vietnam, when he's an actual adult, but being intense for the sake of that's what the situation calls for.
I can't get over how little they did to age Tom Cruise throughout this movie.
Yeah.
I understand he's playing Ron Kovic over the course of some time, even though it's not a long chunk of time, but a lot changes from when you're 18 to 30. Then you toss in all that traumatic stuff that happened to Kovic, including being confined to a wheelchair. How about some wrinkles? Add a few pounds using slight facial prosthetics. Am I wrong, Andrew, that the passage of time seemed to solely be marked by the length of Cruise's hair and mustache?
Maybe it's just me hoping that they did a little bit more, but I think they kind of thinned his hair in the front a little bit to make it look like he might be balding.
I feel like I saw that. I definitely feel like that was a thing.
That's still all just hair stuff, though. John, why do you think that is?
I think this is the beginning of Tom Cruise's... He's transitioning from an actor to a Hollywood movie star. You don't make the movie star ugly in any way.
Yeah, I guess that's true. We gotta see that Cruise face.
It's like the start of the classic, oh, maybe they'll make a movie about you. Maybe Tom Cruise will play you.
And John, what do you think is Cruise's main strength when he's playing the drama in this movie?
Yelling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we'll talk about it in Dead Reckoning. His signature is running, right?
Nowadays it is.
Yeah, but he can't pull that off in this movie for obvious reasons. So his other signature, he's really good at being angry. Who's more angry than a vet who was clearly lied to by his government and now paralyzed because of it?
What about Cruise's yelling or his body language? What specifically sold that anger to you?
I'm going to say that it was justified, that it wasn't out of place. You completely understand why he's angry. It's not him just yelling like in Tropic Thunder. He just yells constantly, but it's funny. This, it's a justified anger. It's not out of place. You totally get where he's coming from. It's acting. It's acting.
I would agree that loud is appropriate in this movie. At that one point, you know, he was screaming the whole time after he got shot in the foot. I mean, I'd be screaming too. This was a good Tom Cruise yelling vehicle where he could scream and it's perfect.
I would add, he's got that all-American look. So I think it makes the character's post-service lows hit harder because Cruise embodies the promise of what a star athlete could do as an adult, except he got paralyzed in Vietnam. The clear sense of personal loss as a result of those guys having been sent over there. If it was somebody that just embodied being a slacker or a loser, it wouldn't be as dramatic. But Cruise, he looks like he could be captain of the football team, or pro wrestler like in the movie, student president. he's just on an upward trajectory, man. But then he goes over there and serves, and it's just so gut-wrenching. Where does Cruz struggle with the portrayal of Ron Kovic? If you think he does at all, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I think there are a couple moments where I saw him move his legs when he was supposed to be in the chair. In terms of like the delivery of the lines and everything, I honestly thought he was pretty spot on. I was watching the wheelchair stuff. It's a serious part of the story, and like I want it to be as real as it can be, considering the story is biographical. I think he moved his legs a little bit here and there.
Well, it was the 80s. Green screen wasn't the biggest thing yet. I'm thinking about Gary Sinise as Lieutenant Dan. Of course you weren't worried about his legs moving because they were green screened out. You know, he was probably doing a little jig the whole time in that chair and nobody would notice.
Constantly kicking. Kicking Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks has to pretend it's not happening. Now that's acting.
It's like, don't worry, Hanks. They'll green screen this out. It'll look like a little wind is fluttering your pant leg. Don't worry. And Tom Hanks just keeps going, ow, ow, ow.
I'm not a smart man, but that hurts.
I feel your invisible legs kicking, my.
Lieutenant Dan, you got your phantom kicks.
What do you think, John? Do you think Cruz has any problems with his performance?
I never noticed the legs, but I will bring up the, I think there's a scene at the end where he lifts himself up in his own chair, and it clearly looks like he's just standing up.
Yeah. Yeah.
To give a speech to a reporter, you're going to gain weight. If you're in a chair all the time, you lose, especially athletic guy like him, and all of a sudden he's not getting any of that exercise, you're going to gain weight. I think you mentioned earlier, Frank, like they should have done something with making him not so pretty Tom Cruise the whole movie.
I'm actually going to be a fuddy-duddy. I'm actually looking at a picture of Ron Kovic from the Republican National Convention at the end. He's still pretty skinny.
Okay, but now I want you to find a picture of Kovic at 17 or 18.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not going to go that far back.
I really think that Cruz is acting his heart out here, but they're letting him twist in the wind by not making more of an effort to age him up a bit. There are points where he's yelling, and it doesn't feel like there's any gravity to it. Because he's got a higher, I guess, register, you would say. How about lower his voice in post-production for at least the scenes after Mexico? I read that Al Pacino had been considered for the part a decade earlier. Imagine him yelling at an anti-war rally.
No! Hooah! He can't not yell. That's what he does, right? It's the same with Tom Cruise. It's like, there should be a movie where they just yell at each other.
But Pacino's going to have that deeper timber, whereas Cruz, every time he yells, I almost think his voice is going to crack. I want a bit more thickness to his voice.
Not everyone sounds like that.
This movie, I think, is an understatement to say it tackles a lot of themes. John, which one resonated with you the most?
If you think sending people to die is wrong, then you're anti-American. That whole sentiment of just, you gotta be pro-American, you gotta be willing to let people die across the globe for no reason, for the wrong reasons. I could give a TED talk on that BS.
Oh, don't you think highly of yourself.
It's such an easy subject.
The hyper-patriotism angle, that's just kind of how it was for some people. Everyone was living in a time of duck and cover and, you know, surviving the nuclear blast, so the hyper-patriotism, it bothered me in the sense of, yeah, these kids were lied to and sold a shit war. I don't want to say it was cartoony at points with Tom Cruise, where he was just so ride and die for America for so long through the movie. And then it did seem like there was that one night where everything changed. So I wish it was kind of more of a gradual thing, I guess. But the guy was under a lot of stress, so I can kind of understand a snap moment.
Since we are on the subject of jingoism, in the scenes where Kovic is defending the Vietnam War and joining the Marines, when he's roughly 18 and right when he gets back from the war and back from therapy, I applaud his fanaticism and putting his life on the line, those discussions he has with other people. However, as the movie demonstrates with the indoctrination of kids back then at an early age, I also wonder how much of it he is truly considered, because it feels like he's just parroting what he's been told, and if so, then it makes his fervor to serve less admirable. In a 1977 interview, the real-life Kovic had this to say.
I grew up with John Wayne, with whole movie cinema image. The whole generation was prepped and hyped and conditioned by our culture, which is so violent, which so romanticizes war. We were ready to go. We were ready to fight. We thought that the war was going to be like the John Wayne movies, but it wasn't. It was different.
He never expected to kill women and children, which was part of the job, from the way his superior officer described it after he felt regret for that. He definitely never intended to shoot one of his comrades, which, again, they just shrugged off. His superior officer just shrugged it off.
Well, he didn't necessarily shrug it off. He was just like, hey, I don't want to do paperwork here. Shut up.
Quiet, son.
Yeah. I hear you, but get out.
Or maybe it would be bad for morale. There could be a couple reasons why the superior officer didn't want to talk about it. Early in the movie, Kovic says to somebody that after he's joined the Marines and he's going to get shipped out, I'm prepared to die for my country. It feels like, through his naivete, he can only think of a glorious, heroic death. He'll come to find out there are a lot of different ways you could die or come close to dying that aren't going to be so great. Andrew, does anything stick out in the filmmaking that feels like a lost art compared to modern films?
One thing I see a lot in modern movies is the colors are all desaturated, so this was a nice look. It just had that classic late 80s, early 90s film grain feel. It's comfy. I will also say, though, like Oliver Stone has never been one of my favorite directors to where I'm like, it's an Oliver Stone movie. It's always been, okay, here we go. It's Oliver Stone.
Yeah, that's how I felt.
Andrew, if you were forced to watch one Oliver Stone movie every year, what would it be?
Wall Street.
Yeah, that's my favorite too.
There are just moments in this movie where you can tell he's very anti-war, and he should be. Even Platoon, I think it was the same messaging. You can only hear war is bad so many different ways. At least Wall Street was different.
Were there any elements of the movie indicative of the time it was made in, late 80s, early 90s? Not specifically of Oliver Stone, but just trends in movie making back then that you wish would pop up more today?
Nothing off the top of my head, given that it was a period piece, because most movies made in the 80s, you could tell it's the 80s. It screams 80s. There's such a flair to 80s movies. This being a period piece really helped it stand out, I think, compared to everything else. It felt more like Oliver Stone than it did being of a specific era.
I'm going to say that the opening act did a great job of giving us snapshots of Kovic's youth. I feel like modern biopics tend to speed through events simply to pass along quick facts. But Stone did it here in a way where it felt like each glimpse in time had the drama to support stopping at those different childhood ages, and they would have made great movies on their own. Like Ron as a boy with a super religious mother. Ron in high school, ultra-competitive wrestler with feelings for the girl next door. It all felt relevant to the character's journey, instead of saying, in a music biopic, let's speed through them meeting each other, because we need to explain that part, but we really don't care. We just need to do the background information as they get to the real part of the story when they're superstars that they want to tell. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
There's every modern biopic just has the one quick scene of like a parent meeting the kid, and then they cut to, oh, his life's perfect.
Andrew, for you, what was the best climax moment?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I'm kind of torn between when he lost the wrestling match and the Mexican hooker.
Those are powerful moments.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say they're in my top four. What was it about the wrestling match that affected you?
You could tell he really felt it, that he let everyone down, that everyone was looking to him, make a name for himself, be the champion, be the best. They make that one of the reasons why he wanted to join the Marines. It's, you know, be the best. You're going to do this. You're going to do that. You know, I'll die over there if I have to. Because he is thinking of the heroic death that everyone's going to remember. The hooker scene. The first time I watched this movie, it was like 13, 15 years ago. And I remember it was a really sad moment. Because you're like, he can't do anything down there. He's sad because it's not working. Rewatching it now, it was more of like a happy climax where it's like, oh, wait a minute. This woman took the time to do things to him. And it kind of shifted my perspective.
Well, because he paid her.
It's a goods and services situation.
It is a goods and services situation, but my outlook on it went from, oh, he's sad because it doesn't work, to, oh, he's happy because, like, he finally got laid. And you can see that he was just happy about it, that, like, something good happened to him for once since Vietnam. I think that's kind of how I took it this time around. Like, he finally had a win, you know? I mean, sure, he had to pay her. But the man finally had a win.
You could buy wins in Mexico.
They're cheaper in Mexico.
Yeah.
The scene that really got me, when Ron confronts his mother after a bender.
Communism, the insidious evil, they told us to go!
Yes, that's what they told us!
Thou shalt not kill, Mom! Thou shalt not kill women and children! Thou shalt not kill, remember?
Stop it! I don't want you in this house! You're out of this house!
Ron, come on now! You made your point, now stop!
No! I haven't made my point, you tell her, Dad! It's a lie! It's a fucking lie! It's just me in his fucking wheelchair for the rest of my life. For nothing, me and his dead penis.
Oh, Ron! No, not with the catheter! For God's sake! Oh, penis!
God. They say it is a sin if you play with your penis. I just wish I could.
Don't say penis in this house! Oh, penis!
Stop!
Penis! Big fucking erect penis,
Stop.
Mom!
He won't let go. What can I do? What can I do?
I haven't even got time to learn how to use it. It's gone in some jungle. Some fucking jungle over in Asia. It's just gone.
And his dad is putting him to bed later, and he sobs, and he says, who's going to love me like this?
That was a sad, sad moment.
He grew up with a possibly overbearing mother, very religious, and he adhered to the tenets of the religion, at least as he knew them. He never got to lose his virginity the typical way. Instead, he finally did it down in Mexico, paralyzed, paying a hooker. So that felt more tragic to me than a happy moment.
There's some tragedy there, yeah. The whole outburst was specifically about his penis in that scene with his mother.
Don't you say that word in this house.
Yeah, exactly. And he just kept yelling it and yelling it and yelling it.
Give me a P! Give me an E!
I was like rocketed back to the 8th grade when he started yelling penis.
John, what was your favorite climax?
It's definitely the scene where he's trying to explain to the family how he's the one who killed their son. The dead soldier's wife with her child said, "This is, I'll never forgive you, but hopefully God can."
Andrew, what's your biggest criticism for this film?
To me, it just did feel kind of sudden, his shift. You can see it when he was talking with Kira Sedgwick after the war. She mentioned Kent State, and he was kind of like, oh yeah, pretty bad, wasn't it? But you can kind of see it, but I do wish it was a little more gradual than it was just like, goes on a bender, America, and then like, you know, he's down in Mexico. Also, I do wish they kind of took a little bit more time to show us how he became kind of a leader within that movement. How did he go from this guy who was telling everyone for a while, this is America, love it or leave it, to he's given a speech at the Democratic Convention. He seems to be the front guy of the protests at the Republican National Convention. Through the movie, you see him as a leader, but I wish they focused a little bit more on his activism and how he got where he was. Because it was just kind of a weird transition to see him leading the charge in there and getting all the microphone time. Unless it was just kind of an accident where he just happened to be the most articulate. But as a big part of his life, it was almost just the end of the movie, literally.
Yeah. How about you, John? What's your biggest critique?
It felt more like Oscar bait at points than it did a movie, a supposed heartfelt movie. But looking at IMDb, it came out in January, so Oscar movies usually come out at the end of the year, right?
Mm-hmm.
I thought I read that they put the movie out in a couple of theaters just so they could qualify for the Oscars.
He's never won either, right? That's one of the big Hollywood, I don't want to say missteps, but I'm talking Tom Cruise actor.
He's never won, no. Which is a shame. Honestly, I believe he was snubbed for Top Gun Maverick and he was snubbed for Collateral.
I would 100% agree with Collateral.
Parallel to your criticism of it, John, I think considering the subject matter and the heavy politics in it, I don't like how much artistic license they took with Kovic's life. As you mentioned, Kovic co-wrote the script with Stone. I wish they hadn't added scenes to up the drama. What happened to Kovic in real life is dramatic enough. For instance, I read Kovic never confessed to killing his fellow Marine to that guy's family. It's a big moment, and finding out it's bogus makes me feel gross and manipulated.
That's too bad, because we talked about how good Tom Cruise is at the yelling acting, but I think that was a really good scene of him just human acting.
Cruise is great, but just the context of it feels off.
You think because Kovic helped co-write this, you think that was him trying to clear his conscience?
Ooh.
Probably.
I could also see Stone saying, hey man, this is a movie, we gotta make it dramatic.
We're doing this. He's high on coke while yelling at Kovic.
Also, Kovic had doubts about the Vietnam War much earlier than was depicted on screen, which I imagine they protracted to better illustrate his arc. I feel like part of the movie's message is shining a light on the way media can be propaganda and romanticize a pro-war stance. Well, I don't think it's much better to gussy up a dude's life story, and by extension, the guys that served alongside him, for an anti-war bend either. Why can't Americans in Hollywood just be satisfied with the facts without adding artificial drama? Like, imagine an Audie Murphy movie. The actor and World War II vet. The guy won a ton of combat medals. Imagine they do a biopic about him and then add another dozen gallant things to his story. You don't need it. John, in Cruise's body of dramatic roles, where does Born on the 4th of July rank for you? Upper, middle, or lower?
It's definitely upper. It's definitely some of his finer acting.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. There was like a stretch of time from like Top Gun through, I'll put the stopper at Last Samurai, which I also haven't seen. I feel like that era of Tom Cruise is kind of like his best acting era. Because you have this, you have Rain Man, you have A Few Good Men, even the first Mission Impossible. I would put this upper though, this is definitely good.
I'm going to go upper as well, because I'm thinking, is there any other lead role where he's portraying someone at such low points? He killed a comrade. He shot civilians. He recuperated at a rat-infested hospital. His dick didn't work. Not his usual suave, bulletproof type role.
That's true.
John, do you have any final thoughts on Born on the 4th of July?
It took too long to get to Willem Dafoe, and I'm pretty sure Willem Dafoe was the same character from Platoon, but he faked his death.
Ooh, I love it. I love shared universes. Let's do it. And Tom Berenger shows up too.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that before he died in Platoon?
Yes, that is. Immediately Tom Berenger went out, watched Willem Dafoe fake his death by, I guess, paying hundreds of Viet Cong to pretend shoot him.
Oh my god. All right. It's... Give us a holler, thescreencompanion at gmail.com. Tell us what recommendations you digged, which ones we were wrong, and who your favorite guests are. The show is on listening platforms like Podbean, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Help us by getting the word out and giving likes. We have short clips to get you in the mood on the TSC Highlights channel on YouTube. If you want to throw some change at me, check out Traversal, The Weight of Worlds, a sci-fi novel written by your humble host, available in print and digital on Amazon. Now, back to the show. Let's get into Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, Part 1. Here we have Ethan Hunt and his spy team going after two parts of a key that, when combined, will help them destroy a sentient AI called The Entity that has spooked the world's intelligence services. Andrew, since you literally saw this yesterday night?
Yep.
What was your first feeling or thought when the movie ended?
I really liked it, but I felt like the Mission Impossible movies, starting with 4, 5, and 6, I felt like they honestly just kind of got better. This one, I'm not quite sure if it's better than Fallout. I don't think it is, but it was still really good.
That's a valid opinion, because I didn't like 3. People seem to love 3.
If you take Julia out of 3, then I don't like 3 at all.
All right. Okay, thank you. But yeah, they definitely were getting better, and I do feel like this one misstepped a little. There's a huge, huge elephant in the room, because the bad guy is artificial intelligence. I get it, it's the IMF versus math, which has kind of been their whole deal every movie, right? Like, it's supposed to be impossible, and they still pull it off. But it's a big elephant in the room, and nobody seems to be talking about it.
When I first heard it was AI, I thought, well, a lot of techno thrillers from the early to mid-90s, Harrison Ford's Jack Ryan movies, those get very brainy, and you have scenes where Jack Ryan, the CIA analyst, is poring over satellite photos and looking at dossiers. But they work. They're great scenes. They help move the plot along, and it's cool to see our hero use his brain, so I think there's a way you could do it where it can come off as smart and engaging. But yeah, I don't quite think this movie did that.
I will go on record as I think it's going to age really well. I don't think it's going to end up being campy in the end. It's probably going to be just exactly how we all go out.
Yeah.
You mean because in 10 years when robots walk the earth and every human has died, they'll be watching this movie chuckling?
Yeah, they'll be like, like they could beat math.
The first thing I thought exiting the film was this did not need to be a two-parter. There was enough material. I would have preferred just two separate villain stories using the subplots. You know, I don't need this AI thing to stretch into another film, because they didn't do enough to really make me care about the bad guy. I'm surprised Solomon Lane from 5 and 6, I thought he was just useful in 5, but I didn't need to see him again. And then when they did in Fallout, and he was great, a great part of it, and surprised me, it was a nice addition to that film. But they didn't go, okay, Rogue Nation is part one, and then in part two, you're going to face the same baddie again. Everybody get excited. I don't want AI in the next movie. But we're stuck with it because it's a part one.
It is a part one. Yeah, that's, I think you just said, Fallout and Rogue Nation did a really good job disguising it, that it was a part one, part two.
Because I don't think when McQuarrie wrote 5, he didn't go into it going, oh, this is going to be a two-parter. You'll see Lane again. It just happened organically. It's better that way. It also helps that it's a human villain and not AI. Not auto-tuning. When he speaks in Benji's voice.
When they meet it a few times, it straight up growls at people.
I want to take a little survey of you guys. In those moments where we're hearing what could be construed as the entity breathing or growling or whatever, and when we see supposedly the entity at the rave and he's on all the monitors, Do you think it's literally the AI manifesting, or do you think those are more post-production cues to keep it present in the audience's mind?
I guess, like, in the scene, I took it as, like, it was letting everyone know that it's there and it's watching.
So literally, those sounds we're hearing, they're hearing it in the movie as well?
Yes. I don't think it was meant for just the audience. You know, when Tom Cruise is looking around the room, he's kind of like, oh, there it is. I don't think it was meant just to be a reminder for us. I think it was legitimately the AI making a power play and showing up at the rave.
I think I will agree. Yeah, everyone goes to the raves.
Oh, damn. I'm getting all sorts of agreements.
Yeah, John, I didn't bring you on here to agree with Andrew, okay?
All right, fine. Hard disagree. Ignore the scene where they literally say, oh, also the entity is here later, and it growls at Tom Cruise in that meeting with the White Widow.
Even though you guys bring up good points, I think I need it to be non-diegetic, or else the movie becomes much sillier.
I didn't even notice that that was the entity on all the things until they pointed it out to me.
You thought it was just somebody's screensaver?
That's exactly what it looks like. I've never been to a rave, but I've seen it in every other movie, and it's the same thing anyway, and they don't have AI at their raves.
It's this weird juxtaposition between, I want the AI to have, I don't know if I'm going to say personality, but just more of a backstory or an idea of what it wants. But then the more you do that, the more you humanize it. I don't want that at all. And when he talks in Benji's voice, I wasn't going for that. Might as well just make him Skynet and bring in a Terminator.
Yeah, so not a Terminator Tom Cruise.
I wanted to see Ethan get pretty seriously injured.
Good thing you watched Born on the 4th of July.
Certainly.
Man, what a movie the 8th movie would be if he gets paralyzed in the first act.
Oh my gosh.
He's still doing his stunts, but he's in his wheelchair. How amazing would that ending stunt be if it was in a wheelchair instead of on a motorcycle?
If he's in a wheelchair in Dead Reckoning Part 2, he'll be in a cargo plane, the back will open, and he'll just wheel himself out without a parachute.
He'll be in a motorized wheelchair. Those things can go like 30 miles an hour. We'll have a chase scene down London streets.
They'll recreate the skydiving action sequence in Moonraker where he steals another guy's parachute, but he's in the wheelchair.
Oh, actually, going to space would make more sense. There's no gravity up there, so him not having use of his legs would be more believable.
That would, yeah.
Oh, he could whip him around in fight scenes and just, like, whip people in the face with his dead legs.
I'm imagining him trying to break into the CIA again, only this time the cables are attached to his wheelchair and he has to balance in them as he's slowly being lowered. Literally spinning his wheels. So I always figured if you're in the IMF and if you are a field agent that you're going to have your specialties, but you need to be proficient across a range of things, not least of which would be hand-to-hand combat or gunplay.
I would agree with that. There's a field exam for a reason. I'm going to assume the field exam is the same one from Skyfall, where you just walk up on a target and shoot it because your shoulders hurt. But you're going to have to kill people. You're going to have to defend yourself in the field. Yes, your specialty is tech. Ethan Hunt's specialty is running in a straight line and then jumping off something tall.
Well, because in 5, a big part of the plot feels like it's Ethan wanting to protect Benji. And Benji, at a certain point, his perspective is, look, I know what I signed up for. Stop treating me with kid gloves. I'm working out in the field. I'm not just a guy at a computer anymore. So treat me like it. I know the stakes. I know the risks. I'm an adult. Which is why I felt like if he died in this one, it would have been a great cap on his arc from the guy in the office to the guy in the field. It's hard for me to buy, out of all the guys on the team that could die, barring Luther, because I had never felt like he said he was a field guy. He goes out when he needs to, but he's the guy in the crow's nest.
Guy in the chair.
Yeah. So to have one of the better fighters kick the bucket in this one, but Benji's still alive, even though he supposedly goes out in the field a lot, I'm not buying it. I want to see him die. Die!
Maybe it'll happen in the next one.
Oh, I can only hope.
Fingers crossed? What?
I think Hayley Atwell is great as Grace the Thief.
What do you want?
This key. The one you picked from that man's pocket. It's worthless without this key. But together, they're worth 4 million in cryptocurrency that man was carrying on a flash drive.
I wouldn't know anything about that.
And why was this drive in your pocket? I need the man you stole this from to complete a transaction and leave this airport with both of these without ever knowing his pocket was picked or before he boards his flight in...
7 minutes.
7 minutes. We both know you're a good pickpocket. Let's see what kind of put-pocket you are.
You expect me to put it back?
Oh, I know you will. You're a thief. You want the money, and I can give it to you. Your choice. You're in or you're out.
I think it was a worthy trade-off with her character and Ethan being the biggest dynamic in the movie. But since she got all that screen time, it didn't leave much for the established team. So I want the team, as established in previous films, I want more focus on them in part two, especially if part two is the last one we get for a while, if not the last movie. Andrew, Mission Impossible doesn't have the best record with villains. Is S.A. Morales a good successor to Solomon Lane?
He's creepy, but he is a little bland.
He's very watchable, but his presence is the character. It's the fumes. And then once you look past the smoke, I don't really see anything.
They're pretending that he's Jean Reno, right? From the first one? Even though, like, a Jean Reno, he still stabbed people in an alleyway and Ethan couldn't save them, just like in the first movie. But also, it happened before the first movie, so he's a made-up prequel villain.
Oh, I hate that. I hate that.
Yeah, I thought that was weird, too. Okay, so it wasn't like I missed something in the very first movie. This is just...
They just pretended that the first movie's not the first time this has happened to Ethan Hunt. This is pretty standard affair for Ethan Hunt, of watching people he likes get stabbed in alleyways behind gates.
They retcon stuff that I really wish they didn't in this movie. When Gabriel was talking about all the women that Ethan's let down, at least in the movies we've seen, I don't really get that feeling. He certainly lost less female partners / love interests than James Bond has.
Yeah, but Ethan's only had 7 movies so far.
Okay, one died in the first one, right? Second one she got away, but it didn't work out. And then next 4 were just his wife that they decided that she should keep her distance.
Mm-hmm.
And then Keri Russell died in the third one.
Oh, I forgot about her, because that one movie's awful.
I did forget about that one.
John, can we agree that the worst thing in Mission Impossible 3 was J.J. Abrams?
Yes, absolutely. I was going to interrupt you and say the directing, because I didn't think you were going to say him, but he is a problem. Hollywood needs an intervention on that man.
Thank you. You should listen to our Marathon Impossible, where I go at length.
Yeah.
Why I don't like JJ, and where I continually throughout the podcast come back to how much I don't like him.
I'll think about it. I don't know if I'm going to give Andrew's podcast the metrics.
Nothing personal, JJ. I just don't like you professionally.
You're bad at your job. It's okay to tell a story. You don't have to sacrifice it because you think a shot's cool.
It balances out, though. You know, he gets to make millions. I should get to be a little salty.
Yeah.
I think he wouldn't have it any other way. I would, but he wouldn't.
Oh, no, he'd absolutely be like, no, please stay poor.
Andrew, who was the best new character?
I would say Grace.
Yeah, it really is her movie. Hayley Atwell, she's got a nice presence.
She was amazing. I love her. Shout out to Carrie Elways, but I'm giving it the palm.
Yeah, and I don't think it'll shock you guys. You probably thought this when the movie ended. She's coming back for part two.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, I feel like they have to.
She's going to be the new member on the team.
Yeah, that's something I'm worried about going into the second part. because I saw this online too, so it's not like it's an original thought. Nothing is these days, especially as AI takes over. But,
topical.
I hope they're not just using Dead Reckoning as a backdoor pilot to set up this new class of IMF agents. If they do that, I'm fine with it. Like with Palm, Grace, the guy under Shea Whigham's character, that dude, he seemed like he might come over to the other side.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't mind a movie with those characters, but don't try to seed it too much in Dead Reckoning. It still needs to be Ethan's movie and his team, because these are the people we've been following for 3 or 4 movies now. John, what was the best stunt or action beat for you?
I don't want to sound cliche. The jumping off the mountain was amazing. And he did that, I think I read somewhere it was like 19 takes or something like that. And he did over 1,300 skydiving maneuvers to practice because they just strapped a camera to him and that was it. That was how they did it. They didn't fake it. But just the whole training sequence of them getting away was, I thought, beautiful.
I can't think of really any action sequence, because Andrew and I already mentioned the alleyway, the skinny alleyway fight.
Yeah, that was amazing, but that felt like it was from Bourne movies or even John Wick.
Oh yeah, because maybe because it was more brutal than usual for Ethan.
Yeah.
And the quick cutting, there's a lot more quick editing. If we go at it a different way, because I think a lot of the action scenes work in this, Andrew, was there an action scene that fell a little flat to you at all?
The only one that I would say fell a little flat would have been the car chase, only because with the Fiat stuff, I kind of felt like there were a few jokes that I think were drawn out a little too long, but it was still humorous. I mean, that's the thing. Like, it was just a little long in the tooth, but I still thought it was clever. But that's really the only thing I would... They could have edited that down a little bit.
I'm going to bet money that you thought of this during that car chase. Did you get whiffs of Tomorrow Never Dies when they're handcuffed together?
Yeah, slightly. Yeah. And she gets away from him and handcuffs him to something. And it was very Tomorrow Never Dies, which is one of my favorite Bond films, but still.
John, what was your favorite non-action moment or detail?
Well, I can't bring up anything Benji now.
You can. I'll let you. As long as Andrew promises to excoriate you.
I don't want to keep harping on Palm, but her acting through angry...
Palm Wonderful?
Palm Wonderful. Her acting through angry face in all the rave scenes, dressed like she's coming from Cirque du Soleil.
It fit for the party atmosphere, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And she felt terrifying.
An eccentrically dressed French person? I believe that.
Yeah, exactly.
She looked like she had just come out of a marching band practice.
Now she's there to kick Tom Cruise's ass.
Oh, as much as I do like Palm Wonderful, I'm going to say her acting might have been the weakest.
She wasn't given lines. She was just given facial expressions.
She didn't really do much other than, you know, beat the crap out of people.
When she was driving the Humvee through the streets of Venice, she was crushing things, and she was showing some sadism in her face.
Andrew, your favorite non-action moment or detail?
I think that club scene, when all the players meet, I loved it. It was the perfect edge-of-your-seat dialogue scene. That was a great scene.
Actual spy shit.
Yeah.
In a lesser filmmaker's hands, they would just go from one action bit to the next, and that would have felt too much over the top, but yeah, those quieter moments, we need those to bring us down a notch. My favorite detail, and this is a detail I've wanted since the first movie, and something I've always felt makes the spy community at large that Ethan deals with look like amateurs. I loved every time the CIA team leader, Jasper Briggs, played by Shea Whigham, every time he checked to see if the person he was with was wearing a mask.
I did like that, yeah.
It was a good running gag.
I almost popped out of my seat like corn. It's like, finally! If you know this technology exists, I swear to God, if I was an IMF agent, every time my buddy walks out of the room and comes back in, the moment I lose sight of you, once I see you again, I'm going to tug on your face. I'm going to put a gun to your head, make you tug on your eyes to see if there are any seams or masks going on. And as far as I can recall, and John, you've seen them much more recently than I have, do they do that in any movie where they check to see if the guy really has a mask? I think they do once in Fallout, maybe.
Once in Fallout and that's it, but there's a definite reason why no one checks. It's because that stupid mask machine breaks every movie, and Tom Cruise has to be like, well, I hope they don't know what they look like, because I'm going in raw.
Okay, have it break, and then let's go analog. Let's go back to the first movie, where it was more like using theater makeup and putting on a really good show. They go to a Spirit Halloween store and get Ethan a wig. Because, I mean, that can still work. It doesn't always need to be so high-tech.
The security cameras in the Party Cities would have recognized Ethan buying all the makeup, and it would have been able to construct an algorithm to figure out who he's trying to disguise himself as.
Oh, yeah.
What I also love about checking for masks is when Jasper's on the train, and he does it to Kittredge. And I love that Kittredge doesn't freak out. He understands. He knows why the guy's tugging on his face. It makes sense to him. He's annoyed, but he gets it. So this is the longest mission so far, just shy of 3 hours, basically. John, do you think they used the extra time well, or do you think it should have been shorter?
I thought they used it well. It felt like there was enough there that it worked. It didn't seem as long to me as three just went on and no one got a name.
I watched Patriot Games the other night. So it's an adaptation of a Tom Clancy novel, which his books are always gigantic. It centers around Harrison Ford's Jack Ryan mixing it up with an IRA splinter group, bouncing across both sides of the Atlantic, lots of politics, family drama. Andrew, guess the running time on that.
Is it like, oh god, I haven't seen that. I've seen it too. Or did I watch Clear? It doesn't matter. I'm going to say it's a 1 hour 40.
Close. Yeah, it's just shy of 2 hours.
Yeah.
If you could give me that much drama and complexity and, I felt, intelligence in a spy techno thriller story, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 doesn't need to be like 2 hours and 45 minutes. It just doesn't. Andrew, what was your biggest criticism for this flick?
There were a couple points in the movie where my mind wandered. I don't feel like it was as good as Fallout, because I remember when I watched Fallout, I thought it was just so great. I was just into it 100%. With this one, my mind wandered a bit, because there were just some lulls. I don't want to say heavy dialogue scenes necessarily, just things were a little too long. Like, they could have edited it down, and so it gave me a chance to think of other things or think back to the other movies instead of just giving all attention to this one.
I saw this movie with my dad, and as we were driving home, we're talking about the movie, and it hit me. This one lacks an emotional anchor. As much as I like Hayley Atwell's arc, if that's supposed to be the emotional anchor, I think it's woefully inadequate. For example, there's Ethan's survivor's guilt and his dynamic with Phelps from the first one. Fallout had Ethan dealing with regret, and he sees his wife again, and maybe what could have been. Even a turd like MI3 was him trying to stay out of the field and focus on his marriage. It's funny that the third one shows him in a limited IMF capacity, and there's no hint of it in the seventh one. It's like they didn't know it was going to go on this long.
Yeah.
But what do you think, John? Do you think there's an emotional anchor I'm not acknowledging?
Well, Rebecca Ferguson was supposed to be that for the last couple movies, right?
Yeah, I would say it was hers, just in a different way.
Yeah. Star-crossed lovers, I guess would be the term. Of we're from two different worlds, even though this is from the exact same world. But they keep writing her. It's like, I got other shit to do. I gotta go, bye.
On a franchise level, and it's because she's been in multiple movies, it works, her death. And McQuarrie has said in interviews, he doesn't want you to have to have watched the other movies to enjoy the one you're watching right now. Okay, if that's the case, McQuarrie, okay, if she's the big emotional anchor and we haven't seen the other movies, what do they really set up? What moments do they give us with her and Ethan that really make you feel bad when she dies. I can think of them on top of Venice rooftop, and they have one little moment where she nestles into his shoulder. What do they really play in this one for her?
No, it definitely feels like that you've needed to have seen the last three.
And that is a good segue into complaints regarding the franchise as a whole. John, you just got into one of them, which is, I love McQuarrie, but they used to do one director each film, and then they hit on Rogue Nation with him, then he did Fallout. He's got his bag of tricks, man, and they're cool. He's recycling his ideas. Him and his frickin' car chases where Tom Cruise is going in reverse a bunch. We've seen that a lot in his Mission movies. The Jack Reacher movie they did together has a similar car chase scene. It's like, it's only been 7 movies, guys. How about, not that I want them to, but how about some skiing? Or how about a boat chase? You don't need to have a tiny car chase through the streets of a European city every frickin' movie.
Or motorcycle, wait, no. No motorcycles.
They've done a lot of motorcycle stuff already.
I think since 2, you shouldn't be allowed to do motorcycle stuff anymore.
Yeah.
The other thing that I complain about constantly is the dearth of fleshed out, interesting villains.
Oh, yeah.
I definitely felt it on this one where it's just another stand-in villain, you know, just needs someone slightly menacing.
John, where do you think this movie fits into the larger franchise? Like, how would you rank it?
I think it's the 3rd worst. That sounds bad. I think it's the 4th best? Because, yeah, maybe it's better than Ghost Protocol.
Is your biggest bone to pick plot hole related?
I'll go a different route and say I think my biggest bone to pick is character convenience, where they just go completely off character so something can happen. But I'll get into that too.
That feeds into plot holes.
It's plot holes. So it's plot holes.
I know I like it more than 2, 3, and 4. I don't know if I would put it above Rogue Nation or not. Rogue Nation was really good, that's the thing. It is a tough one. I think it would be interchangeable with me for Rogue Nation, but I'd still put it under 1 and 6. For sure.
Ooh, we're very aligned on this. My favorite has been and always will be the 1st. And then I'm going to go Fallout, and then I would go Part 1.
Oh.
Interesting.
And I think the biggest reason why I would put Part 1 ahead of Rogue Nation, A, because in a lot of ways Fallout is just a redo of Rogue Nation, but better. They bring Ilsa Faust back. And guess what? She's at odds with the team again. Oh, when did this happen? The last movie. And she's out of pocket in Dead Reckoning. Why can't she just be part of the team? She gets there. She always gets there. But Part 1, I put it in the 3rd, I think because it's just so snazzy and polished, and this is one that I could put on when I just feel like an action movie. I feel like I can get a lot of utility out of this one. Fallout in the 1st, they have some real emotional moments, and I need to be in a particular place to watch them. Part 1 is that popcorn movie that I used to say was Mission 2, because that's just a mindless action movie. Part 1 has just as much action, but it's better quality. From what they've given us in Part 1, are there things in the story, Andrew, that you're anticipating or hoping they won't do in Part 2?
I'm hoping they don't do the AI casting a hologram to talk with Ethan directly.
Oh, yeah.
You just cursed it.
I know. That's the problem. I know I did that too. And they're going to have it morph. It'll be all the villains from the Mission Impossible movies talking to him.
Oh my god, no. Don't show me my worst nightmare.
And then what'll happen is at the end of it, like after it goes through all the villains, it'll just be like, who's your greatest adversary, Ethan? And it'll turn into Ethan, and it's just like, yeah, there you go.
The 1st hologram's still gonna be John Voight, though.
It'll be John Voight. maybe it'll go sequential through the movies.
Oh, that'd be even cheesier.
John Voight, Australian dude. No, Philip Seymour Hoffman, they can't. They will. God damn it, Andrew.
They have to.
Yeah.
Dude, like, and that's the thing. They'll AI Philip Seymour Hoffman into the movie about AI. There you go. A double entendre. That's what I don't want. I don't want the AI to physically manifest somehow, and I'm afraid that they'll have a scene like that.
Wait a second. You're okay with the AI having a personality, talking, writing to Ethan, but you draw the line at giving him a face?
I do draw the line at that, yeah. I feel it's more menacing without a face.
If you can't relate to it in any way, it is more menacing.
And I guess I don't want the end-all be-all of the AI's plan to be triggering a simultaneous launch of all nukes. I don't want it to be like a world-ending event. I just want it to be like it's in control and it tries to enslave humanity. Something like that. Like, I think I'd be more happy with that than like Skynet.
True AI isn't just going to pop up and announce itself and give anybody a chance. It's not even going to try and kill all humans. No offense to Bender Bending Rodriguez, but it's going to hide itself. It's going to control from behind the scenes.
The chief thing they need to not do in part two, they better not bring back Ilse Faust, because it'll undercut the most emotional moment from part one. And 5 years from now, there's a couple things I'll still remember about part one. I'm going to pretend like I'm not going to watch this every year or two like all the other Mission movies, but, you know, for a second, go with me. 5 years from now, I'll remember a few things, and that death is going to be number one. And if that turns out to be a fake out, right now the movie's like a 3.5 out of 5, and if they bring her back to life, that'll drop it to a 3, just from that one detail. Don't make it like a comic book movie. People need to stay dead. It's not the choice I would have made, but they made it, and they need to stick with it, or else none of it matters. Well, let us move on to the final segment, TLDL. Too long, didn't listen. I'm going to ask you guys some rapid-fire questions to round out this show. Andrew, if we disregard the anti-war message of Born on the 4th of July, do you think the movie works if a viewer wants to watch it as the story of a disabled person coming to terms with their disability?
Yes, it would work, but I think it would be a little weaker.
John, considering you watched the other Mission movies to get caught up for Dead Reckoning Part 1, what are the chances someone can enjoy the 7th movie without having seen any of the others?
I'm saying 0.
Another one for you, John. Is it more novel to see Tom Cruise get put through the ringer as Ron Kovic, or for him to be a villain, like in Collateral or Interview with the Vampire?
I think it's nostalgic to see him get put through the ringer as the hero.
Andrew, if someone hasn't seen the Mission movies before, and they're willing to watch 2 previous entries before Dead Reckoning, which 2 would you recommend?
I would probably, just for continuity, recommend Rogue Nation and Fallout, because those, I think, are the 2 most important leading into this one.
John, what would be a worse idea? Watching Born on the 4th of July with a pro-Vietnam veteran, or someone's devout mother?
Both of those parent comparison to watching a J.J. Abrams movie. Yeah, zinger. Definitely the devout mother.
Andrew, in general franchise terms, who do you like more, Ilse or Grace?
Ilse.
Interesting. Do you think Grace has possibly peaked with her arc to getting to a point where she trusts Ethan in this part one? Or do you think there's a lot more to mine with her in the second one?
I think this arc is complete. I think they'd have to give her another arc in the second.
John, is Dead Reckoning best watched on a date, with friends, or by yourself?
Friends, if they're Mission Impossible fans.
I would also have accepted with J.J. Abrams, so you could point to a good mission movie.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Andrew, who gave a better supporting performance? Willem Dafoe in 4th of July or Henry Zerny as Kittredge in Dead Reckoning?
Oh, Willem Dafoe. The man's a gem.
He's a peach.
Final question for both of you. We'll start with John.
That's me.
If you had to shorten one of these 2-hour-plus films, which would you cut 15 minutes out of?
I'm going with Born on the 4th of July.
Do you agree, Andrew?
That's a tough one, because when you mentioned the novel question, it is more novel to see Tom Cruise kind of suffer, so I kind of want that suffering. I would shorten Dead Reckoning, actually. My attention wavered more during that one than it did during Born on the 4th of July.
Where, may I ask, would you do it?
With a 2-hour, 43-minute movie, I can cut 15 minutes literally from just seconds of scenery and stuff like that. I think I would just cut... Actually, you're right. I mean, that's the thing. Like, the movie was... It was just long, but it was pretty tight.
Maybe cut some for the HX sequence, but it fit together so well.
That Fiat scene was pretty long. I think you could cut a good minute or two from that alone.
I'd cut out the opening sub scene.
I don't think I would cut it. I would just shorten it.
That could be shortened, probably, yeah. I like the movie. It's fun to tear it down, but I love the movie.
Do you think it's possible that they will have like a 20-minute exposition dump in part 2 that will satisfy you as to the plot holes in part 1?
No.
McQuarrie's going to listen to this and he's taking notes.
He better.